afternoon, Your Honors. I rise to introduce Jonathan Shapiro, a member of the Bar of the State of New York, who will present argument on behalf of the appellant in this matter.
Welcome to the court, Mr. Shapiro.
Thank you. May it please the court, Jonathan Shapiro on behalf of Meyer and Mersolet, plaintiff below and appellant here. This court has made clear, most recently in its rulings in Nemec v. Schrader and in Dunlop v. State Farm, that a claim for breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing requires proof that the other party acted arbitrarily or unreasonably, thereby frustrating the fruits of the bargain that the asserting party reasonably expected. Mr. Mersolet respectfully submits that the Court of Chancery erred in requiring he prove that the defendants acted in bad faith and requiring that he prove that defendants were motivated by a culpable mental state and their conduct was driven by an improper purpose. Here, unlike in Nemec, the contract did not authorize the defendants' actions. Nowhere in the merger agreement did it give the right to the defendants to extend and then arbitrarily cut off the deadline for accepting elections for merger consideration without setting a new deadline and providing appropriate notice to members, including plaintiffs. Defendants acting outside of the merger agreement not only failed to set a new election deadline date, but they failed to set a new election time of day. And this is critical because the merger agreement sets the election deadline at 5 p.m. on the date selected, unless another time is set. And no new time was set here. Once a late election submitted after 5 p.m. on January 18, 2007, was honored as the last late election by defendants, then under the terms of the merger agreement, the deadline could only have been 5 p.m. on January 19, 2007. This is a deadline that plaintiff met. Nevertheless, defendants arbitrarily and unreasonably refused to honor plaintiff's election.
That's one inference that you could draw. The other is that the new deadline was 5 p.m. on January 18th, and that the defendants should have excluded the last member who got in past the wire.
That is an inference that you, I suppose, or another argument that one could make, and that again would show that this has just been an arbitrary procedure. And part of the problem here is, while defendants are pointing to the sanctity, predictability of contract terms, they're ignoring what the actual contract here provides. They're relying on a January 29th deadline, which they say is a deadline, which told them that they had to close out this late exception election window precisely when they did. But the reality of it is, at the trial record is clear. First off, we don't even know when they closed this election deadline. There's no record of it. So the best that we have in the trial record is that they decided to avert disaster, as they say, by closing this election deadline either making the decision to close the election deadline either in the evening of January 18th or the next morning of January 19th. There's no documentation of that.
Well, let me put the question to you this way. What is it that you contend should have, that the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing required be done, factually? That is, what would have been the lawful scenario?
Yeah.
And secondly, what would be the rule of law that we would have to adopt or affirm in order to support the result that you argue for?
Sure. The rule of law, I think, has already been set out by this court. Again, as this court has said, with the goal to honor reasonable expectations of the parties, we look at what the contracting parties would have agreed to prescribe had they thought of negotiating with respect to those matters. Now, to your first point, Your Honor, had the parties foreseen the need to extend the election deadline here, they would not have permitted defendants they would have required that defendants set a new objective deadline. So to your question, they should have set a new objective deadline per the merger agreement, and they should have given appropriate notice
and told everybody what it was.
Told everybody what it was. They didn't do that here. And the Court of Chancery itself, described the defendant's conduct as on the fly and described the defendant's opening and closing of this supposed election, extended election window as haphazard. That is not what the law says here. Remember, the law is clear that we rely on the agreement, right? Implied covenant, good faith and fair dealing is a gap-filling procedure. And here, again, they should have had a new objective deadline. It should have been given notice. And also, as far as the items that clearly the parties would have prescribed had they thought to negotiate this matter, clearly the parties would not have allowed two elections submitted on the same business day to be treated differently, and that's precisely what happened here. Like in Dunlop, defendants' exercise of discretion deprived Mr. Mercer.
Well, to put it in terms of the doctrine, you're saying that to treat two submissions that were made on the same business day oppositely is arbitrary.
Exactly. And particularly, I would say in this case, I mean, and not unlike most others, I'm coming back to the agreement. I recognize that that's what governs. The agreement itself is what sets out that it's the close of business. It says 5 p.m. right in the agreement. So, that is yet another reason why I'm relying on this close of business, because that's what's in the agreement. And ultimately...
But under the agreement, hadn't the date already expired?
Yes. Yes.
So in terms of saying, well, I'm following the agreement, and they didn't follow the agreement, and those kinds of arguments, what happened was the agreement specifically said day one. On day one, your client and a few others had not made their elections. An effort was made to contact everybody who had not made an election and say, I'm not even sure that you'll be able to do so, but you better get it in a hurry and all that kind of thing. How does that add up to a lack of good faith?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, yes, the only disclosed and the original election deadline was January 5th, 2007 at 5 p.m., and that was only disclosed in that election form. So if you didn't get an election form like plaintiff, you didn't know of when that election deadline was unless someone specifically told you, and the record's clear about that. To your point exactly, 25 other late stock elections were accepted after January 5th, but not my clients. Mr.
As I understand your argument, it really goes to fair dealing. And what you're contending is that if you're going to deal with someone fairly, there has to be an objective benchmark. And that in this particular case, there's no objective reason that we can look to or benchmark we can look to ascertain why someone who filed at 7:30 at night on the 18th was timely and someone who filed at 11:30 in the morning on the 19th was late.
Exactly right, Your Honor. This is the good faith and fair dealing. And I think sometimes we lose sight of that fact. It's not just the statute. It's not the implied covenant of good faith. This court in Dunlap, in the insurance context, said that courts have gotten this wrong when they've looked at as the lack of good faith being the same as bad faith. And our position is it's not two sides of the coin.
And well, your argument, if I understand it, and maybe I have it wrong, is that while it may be appropriate for a trial court, or for any court, to require a showing of bad faith or improper motive or improper purpose, that is subjective bad faith, if the claim is that the performance of the contract was done in bad faith, that is not the case where the claim is that the performance of the contract constituted unfair dealing, as that term is used in the confines of the doctrine.
I think if I understand your question correctly, yes, what we're saying is that once you've gone outside the contract, and now we're talking about gap fillers, we're talking about the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, and this court's rulings say that you have to exercise that those rights with in a way that is fair, and again, this has to be in good faith. And what that means is, again, they cannot lose sight of the fruits of the bargain that someone reasonably expected to achieve here.
Well, the way I read the chancellor's opinion, he said nobody did anything in bad faith. They extended the deadline, and not only did they extend the deadline, but they tried to call everybody and said, send it in now. We don't know if we're going to take it or not, but send it in now. So they were acting in good faith and trying to give people a reasonable opportunity. But that's really not the focus of your argument, because your argument is focusing on the fair dealing. They might have been acting in good faith to give everybody an opportunity, but it's not fair to tell them when the opportunity expires.
You're correct, Your Honor. And to be clear, our argument is not that defendant specifically singled out Mr. Mirsalay. There was a lack of a fair dealing, but also our argument is that the information that was provided to Mr. Mirsalay was not the same that was provided to, for instance, Mr. Bowling and Mr. Davis, which you see in our papers. Those were two industry leaders that were able to get the CEO of Intercontinental Exchange on the phone, and the Chancery Court found what we demonstrated at trial, that they did, in fact, receive additional information and benefits. Now, granted, the Chancery Court did not view that to amount to much. We think it does, because if plaintiff had been told when he was speaking to member services on numerous occasions, information, any of the bits of information that these two gentlemen were given by Mr. Sprecher, then he would have had an opportunity to get his election in, too.
Well, the Court of Chancery made factual findings that seemed to not give credence to the argument that anyone was playing favorites. But that really, as I understand it, is not the thrust of your position. It simply is that if there's a timely filing at 7:30 at night on the 18th, and your client's filing the next day at 11:30 was untimely, and there ought to be a way to determine that. And in the absence of an objective determination as to when your client would be late, your client shouldn't be the only person of the more than 25 people who filed late that doesn't get to participate.
That is right. And to add to that point, if I may, the defendants there's nothing in the record to demonstrate that there was going to be any prejudice if they didn't allow my client's election to be submitted, to be honored.
I think the point that Justice Holland's inquiring about, and I am too, is that while there may be a role for subjective bad faith, if the focus of the argument is that the contract was performed in bad faith, or that the counterparty acted in bad faith to prevent the other side from getting the benefit of the bargain, where the focus is on unfair dealing, it isn't necessary to get into the subjective good faith or bad faith of either side of the contract.
That's
what you're being asked about.
Yeah, and I'm sorry if I'm not directly answering your question.
Yes would be a good answer.
Yes. Yes, of course. Can I just make the point as well that there is no justification for defendants' actions? You know, they point to NEMEC for support, but again, their main argument is that January 29th deadline, which wasn't a deadline at all. They point to a January 29th contractually mandated distribution deadline. But if you look again at the actual contract, the merger agreement, it simply doesn't say that. It says by January 29th, the only thing that
You're saying that just as an evidentiary matter, there's nothing in the record to show that civilization would fall apart if the deadline wasn't fixed at 5 o'clock p.m. on the 18th.
Or on the 19th.
The 19th, whatever.
That's right. But that's their position is that they, in relying on NEMEC, that they were justified in taking this action because the sky was falling. Because they, you know, they had to cut it off then and there. Again, there's no support in the record for that. In fact, the one document in the record where defendants discuss anything related to this January 29th deadline and their understanding of it is you can be found at Appendix 504. And this is defendants' January 19th, 2007 release to members. And explaining, and this is around the time that they were closing this window.
Well, the argument I gather is that fair dealing would have required setting an objective date and time, and telling everybody who was potentially affected of
yes.
that information.
Yes.
And to the extent the argument was that, well, it would have just been impossible legally and. Logistically to do that, the answer is the record doesn't support that. It was logistically possible.
That's correct, Your Honor.
I mean, is that your position?
That is my position.
I want to make sure I understand some of the facts here. You did mention that your client did not get the election form.
Correct.
But others did.
Others. There was a mailing that went out on December 19th, 2006. There, a number of people did get it, but a lot of people, dozens and dozens in the record.
Okay, well, was it not sent to him, or they simply didn't receive it? Do you know?
He never received it. He did receive it. Sorry.
Was it sent to him, or he just didn't receive it? That's the question.
They put an affidavit indicating they sent it to the correct address.
Okay.
He never received it. He had received things in the past.
Is it correct that the agreement provided for an election deadline on or before 5 p.m. on the fifth day before the members' meeting?
The actual merger agreement doesn't set a specific calendar day. It says it's on 5 p.m.
the fifth day before the member meeting.
Right, or some other date that the parties mutually agreed to. Ultimately, the deadline was set at that other date that they mutually agreed to, which was January 5th, 2007. And that was then disclosed in the election form only.
Did your client meet that deadline or not?
The January 5th deadline?
Yes.
No, he did not.
Okay. I want to make sure that the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing doesn't morph somehow into a commercial equal protection doctrine or principle. If the defendants followed the agreement and your client missed the deadline, why is it any part of the analysis that others who didn't meet the deadline were allowed to make the election?
We concede if the defendants kept to the only disclosed January 5th, 2007 deadline, we wouldn't be here today. We would not have a claim. But once the defendants decide to operate outside the terms of the merger agreement and decide to open up the agreement, open up, extend to late elections, at that point, we now we're looking at an issue of filling in a gap. Okay, what would the parties have agreed to prescribe had they thought of negotiating that matter? And that it would happen here, it appears from the record, and that a number of people missed the deadline. It was the mailing was done over the holidays, and there was serious problems. The record reflects that some 30%, roughly 30% of all the elections. Town elections came in the day of or the day before. There was a mad scramble.
Boiled down to his essence, wasn't the Chancellor's holding that in order to sustain a, characterize it how you want, bad faith or unfair dealing, there had to be some showing that as to your client, there was some intent to deal with him unfairly or in bad faith. Otherwise, the defendants could rely upon the terms of the original agreement. No matter what they did, in respect to others?
Well, I think we respectfully disagree with the Chancery's position.
Was that their holding? Have I missed?
No, that is the holding. We have to show specific bad faith, mental improper conduct vis-a-vis our client. And we would say that that's not what the rule should be. Again, it's got to be
In other words, your position is as long as the effect of the decision made by the other contracting party is unfair, you don't have to show that they intended it, that it be unfair.
And yes, Your Honor, yes. And Your Honor, that's consistent with this court's prior holdings. It's the conduct frustrates the underarching purpose of the agreement. These decisions don't say that someone specifically had it out for Mr. A or Mr. B. It's that their conduct frustrated the benefit of the bargain.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
You want to save your time for rebuttal?
Yes, I'd like to save my time for rebuttal, please.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, Your Honors.
Before you get started, could you help me out with a factual issue? Did anybody else get caught in this bind? In other words, that within, you know, in less than 24 hours of the, you know, final deadline, as it turns out, one person made an election. Were there any others that were in that position?
No, Justice Berger, there were not. As I understand it, there were only three people who submitted forms after the deadline that was subsequently set, the decision not to accept late elections, Mr. Merceley being one. The other two asked for cash, I believe. Only Mr. Merceley asked for stock. There were others who never responded, but of the three that responded after the deadline, the new deadline, only Mr. Merceley asked for stock and didn't receive it.
What was the new deadline?
Well, I believe it's fair to say that the new deadline was the time of the last submission, which happened to be mine, Mr. Davis, on January 18th at 7:38 p.m., I believe.
How was that established?
That was established by Mr. Sertakowski, who was the head of the legal team from ICE.
In the moment.
Was delegated to be in contact with computer shares and was constantly dealing with the question of how long can we wait. Obviously, the intent...
Someone told him we can wait until 7:30 on the 18th.
No, Your Honor, it was retroactively decided. It was retroactively decided.
So they already had...
They had received Mr. Davis's submission.
How about the submission at 11:30 a.m. on the 19th?
That was actually at 2 p.m. on the 19th.
2 p.m.
That had not been decided.
Had not been received?
It had not been received. This was determined late in the evening on the 18th or early on the morning of the 19th. Mr. Merceley's submission, which we had no reason to believe was on its way, was submitted at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the 19th.
Well, this is perhaps doesn't matter, but it's curious to me that on the one hand there was an effort being made to contact everyone who had not submitted their elections, and then there was an effort made to kind of keep that date moving as you were waiting to hear from all these people. And then you get down to the last three people, and as it turns out, the last one person who was going to make an election for stock. And then all of a sudden you say, well, we now have decided that the close-off date was sometime before you submitted yours. On the one hand, I don't know whether that has any legal significance, but on the other hand, I sure am curious about that.
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. And, of course, that was a focus of much of the testimony at trial. This was not a situation in which we knew who was going to respond and who was not.
But at that point, you knew there were only three people left, right?
No. There were more than three people. There were several people who never responded at all and so who were deemed no election shares and received cash. There were quite a number of them.
All right. Well, can you give me an idea of how many people were in the we haven't heard from you category?
Yes, I can. And were all of them getting emails and special contacts to hurry up, get it in immediately?
Yes, they were, Your Honor. There were 25 members who did not submit at all. There were, therefore, 28 members who submitted after January 18th.
Okay, so then, not meaning to put words in your mouth, but from your client's perspective, there was the possibility that if the deadline kept being extended so that more people could respond, it wasn't that just one or even three people were still out there, so to speak, but there was a significant number of people and therefore the potential for confusion, disorder, whatever.
Yes, ma'am. And I think it's fair to...
To follow up on that, the three persons who were... this case focused on were all in communication in one form or other with employees of the company or the company's acquirer in connection with the obligation to submit a return.
Yes,
that
Justice
is
Davis,
an election.
As were the other 25 members. Who never responded, and I want to point out.
There were some people who never responded at all. Period.
Yes.
Never had their secretaries make phone calls, but Mr. Amorsalas did have his secretary was talking to I guess her counterpart at NYBOT or somebody there knew, that there was a problem. So it's not, I mean, isn't it fair to say that Mr. Amorsala was differently situated than the folks who never responded or communicated at all?
He was more favorably situated than other people. We reached out to Mr. Amorsala. It was not that Mr. Amorsala reached out to us. We left messages urgently indicating that there was a prospect for an expanded window in which to respond.
What does the record show? On, you said the cutoff date for submission was established when Davis's was received. And that decision
Mr.
was
Davis's, it was, I don't want to suggest that it was we were waiting for Mr. Davis.
Oh, I understand. That was at issue in the trial, and that was resolved. But my question is, what does the record reflect on the consequences of extending it to the 19th? You heard the questions, you know, of your opponent, and there seems to be a suggestion that if you didn't cut it off, as you did, on the night of the 18th, there would be dire consequences, and you couldn't wait until the end of business under the 19th under any circumstances.
Yes, Justice Holland, first I want to preface it by saying that the testimony at trial was, from Mr. Sprecher in particular, that if there had been an opportunity to extend this indefinitely, he would have done it. He wanted everybody in. He was hoping during that window of time that everyone would come in. The countervailing point is the one that you referenced, and that is that ComputerShares was advising us that they had work to do. They had to allocate the consideration. They had to document the stock and the cash.
My question is, in the record, is there an email, telephone call, testimony? What in the record corresponds with the evening of January 18th being the date beyond which the world would come to an end in this transaction?
Well, there is the testimony of Mr. Armato of ComputerShares, which was submitted by deposition. And there is the testimony of Mr. Surdykowski, who was in contact with him and who testified that he was being told that ComputerShares was constantly saying, we need to cut this off.
I understand that. My question is, why was cutting it off on January 18th critical?
It was critical because ICE stock, well, it was critical because there was a deadline by which we were obligated under the contract to distribute the merger consideration. That time, that is the time between what had originally been January 5th and January 29th, had now been cut by more than half. If we did not meet that distribution deadline, we could have very well been liable for literally tens of millions of dollars. ICE stock.
So the record reflects, if you didn't cut it off on January 18th, you would have been unable to perform.
We faced the risk that we would be unable to.
Would you or would you not?
Well, I think we have to look at this, Your Honor, with all due respect, at the time that the decision was made. We knew we had very little time, and our expert was telling us they needed to start immediately if we were to avoid a reasonable risk that we would be held or we would fail to meet the distribution deadline. I mean, I think it's clear as a bell from the record that this was the concern. In fact, it was the only concern that precluded us from holding this open indefinitely in order to allow everyone to respond in one way or another.
From a legal standpoint, would you agree that your client could have basically insisted on adhering to the original January 5th deadline?
Absolutely.
And if there were 30 or 40
Absolutely.
Or 140
yeah.
people who didn't submit by then, too bad, there would be no contractual violation.
There's no question here, Your Honor, and I think the Chancellor so found.
All right.
Explicitly that.
And we know that your client, you know, in an effort to avoid that, did extend the deadline. But the decision to do that wasn't actually made until much later in the game. That is almost on the eve of the same day that they decided to drop the flag.
Well, it was clearly decided on the fly. That is correct.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What does the record show, if anything, about the people on your side were thinking in terms of the need to tell these 30 or so folks, or how many were left, of the exact date and time after which they would forfeit?
The record shows that the decision how long we could continue to accept late filings was being considered as the communications were being made. And so the communications that were made from the NIBOT member services offices to all of the people who had not yet responded.
Right, but the communication was, look, hurry up and get in your election.
Yes.
We can't tell you if it's going to be accepted.
That's absolutely what it was. And if we had said get it in by an hour from now, I don't imagine that anybody would have acted any differently.
But if they, if you had said get it in a week from now by 5 o'clock
yes,
at the latest.
We didn't have a week. We didn't have a week.
My question is, was any consideration given to communicating
yes.
that?
Well, communicating.
The time as well as
the
date.
Now, we did not give it, as clear as a bell, that we did not give a time and a deadline in advance to the people that we were speaking to by phone. What we were saying to them is what Your Honor has indicated, and that is there is an opportunity here if you get your late filing in, which incidentally is now 2 weeks late. If you get your late filing in, it may be that we can accept it, but you have to act immediately. Urgently. Mr. Mercelet was told in particular, you need to act urgently. He decided not to. He went to bed. He got up the next morning. He sent it in at 11 o'clock his time, 2 o'clock our time. And that was too late to fit within the window that we had created. I'm afraid that's what it comes down to. Mr. Mercelet has shown a sort of serial indifference throughout this transaction. And I would suggest that the idea that my client, who was in fact acting above and beyond the requirements of the contract in an effort to serve not just Mr. Mercelet, but as many members as possible, could be in violation of some implied provision of the contract by doing so, is very difficult to understand.
Why doesn't the covenant require, why didn't it require, some kind of public notice on the website or in some other way? This is the real deadline. Everybody's on notice, and then let the chips fall where they may.
Well, that certainly could have been the possibility. That could have been a possibility, one of many. There is evidence in the record that there was a concern that if we had broadcast the fact, not just to the members who had not responded, but to all members, including those who had, that we would be in receipt of an avalanche of resubmissions, that everyone who had already submitted would, well, not everyone, but several, many, might have tried to revise their submission, change their allocation. That would have made the problem worse.
Well, you could have said no one who's already submitted can resubmit. This applies only to those who haven't yet submitted.
There's more than one possibility. The other one, certainly, and the one that we pursued was that we contacted individually by telephone, fax, and email, all of which Mr. Mercelet received incidentally, every one of the people who had not responded and said, hurry, there's still a chance. Did we say after an hour from now there won't be? No, we didn't, because we didn't know that. But this was an efficient, we think, way in which to reach that limited constituency of members that we were concerned with. And the Chancellor found, I think with support in the record, that it was a good faith effort to attempt to contact the people we were trying to reach, that there was no evidence of selectivity or bias, and that it was a perfectly legitimate way, if somewhat disorderly, to go about the task at hand.
What is your response to the argument that establish a violation of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, it is not necessary to show subjective bad faith or bad motive?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's entirely wrong, and I think it's dangerous, to be honest. I don't think that the case law, I have not seen a case where someone has been found guilty of violating the implied covenant accidentally. The case law talks about fraud, misrepresentation, deception, moral obliquity, subterfuge. Those are the only cases that I have seen, and I think it's quite dangerous to suggest that one can violate the implied covenant without trying to do so. And I'll say why.
So there has to be a showing of subjective bad faith.
Bad faith, motive. I believe so. And I think to hold otherwise would be to suggest, or at least invite the prospect, that a reviewing court would say that, well, if someone's acting by accident and accidentally breaches an implied term, it's important to the covenant that that implied term be a shared agreement. It's very clear that the narrow compass of this provision only reaches implied agreements between the parties, so fundamental that they didn't need to be written down, and so fundamental that we know exactly what the parties would have done had they thought to write it down. To suggest that one party acted by accident, that is, without knowledge that that implied covenant existed, that implied agreement existed, is to wildly expand what is at bottom a very narrow theory.
Well, you're introducing a term in the analysis that I don't think anybody has argued for, and that is the concept that that a party has to know or doesn't know that there is an implied obligation to perform in good faith and to deal fairly. To the extent that there's that bad motive or bad faith, actual bad faith is relevant, doesn't it go toward the motive of the party in performing the contract?
It does.
That is to the motive to deprive the other side of the contract of the benefit of the bargain.
Yes, but not only as viewed by that one party, as I suspect my point that I'm not very clearly articulating. It has to be, as of the date of the contract, a provision on which the parties implicitly agreed. If one party can breach it by accident, that suggests that in many cases that party didn't understand that that was an implied provision of the contract. And so it seems to me that we are going to be sweeping in a whole broader class of potential breaches, and we are in the process going to be undermining the predictability of contractual relations that I think supports our commercial dealings. I think people have to understand that their contractual obligations are what they say they are. There is a narrow compass of conduct where that won't be true, but it will require bad faith.
Can we move away from the good faith, bad faith, and move over to fair dealing? Because that arguably is a separate component of the implied covenant. I guess generally they would be expected to go together, but it doesn't seem to me inconsistent to say, well, there was no bad faith, there was no intent to harm or whatever, but nonetheless, the way we carried this out did not comport with the implicit understanding of what fair dealing would be under these circumstances. Now, granted, these circumstances were not what was originally part of the contract because you've already extended the deadline, but wouldn't it be appropriate under this covenant to have expected that whatever extension you decided you could give would be done fairly?
I think it's certainly reasonable. I don't think there's anything in the record, anything at all, that suggests that what we did was not fair to everyone who was affected by the process. Anything
okay,
at all.
So if I understand you, what you're saying is that, yes, one way of doing it fairly would have been to say, okay, we're extending it to January 15th at 5 o'clock and try to tell everybody that that's the new deadline. You didn't do it that way. Instead, you tried to reach everybody and told them to file immediately. But you were still being fair. You were just using a different technique.
I believe that's right, Your Honor. And I don't mean to skirt the underlying policy argument that Your Honor has raised, which is, does an unfair dealing somehow constitute some sort of snap-on addition to the implied covenant of good faith? I think there's a danger here that we might regard unfair dealing in this context as the equivalent of what Weinberger announced. I think the covenant of good faith and unfair dealing far preceded the decision in Weinberger. This is not a fiduciary analysis. I think that those two provisions, I've not seen a case that separated them and said, well, there are certain rights and obligations that one has under the fair dealing part and another under the good faith part. I think they're one and the same, frankly. Well, I think they're a part of the same concept.
One could make the argument that if you segregate them completely and don't read them as a whole, despite the conjunction and, that if you analyze unfair dealing separately, you fall into the trap of hindsight review of the consequences of an action rather than focusing on what the party's original agreement may have been and what they could fairly have implied were their respective obligations under the contract. And that gives judges a whole realm of experimentation with how they would have liked to have seen the result come out.
That is true, and I think ironically it is comparable, not to start a whole new discussion here, comparable to the concern that many expressed when the idea of bad faith was raised in the context of corporate fiduciary obligations. The concern that in hindsight one would, using the bad faith analysis, be able to undermine the business judgment rule by saying, well, it's so egregious that you couldn't have not anticipated that that was coming. Clearly, expanding this principle will wildly expand the obligations of contracting parties, and in a way that's not written down anywhere. I don't know how that can help but destabilize the ability of contracting parties to rely on what is supposed to be the document that defines their relationship.
Well, there's a worse nightmare. The legislature could decide to pass a statute purporting to define the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing.
Yes, sir, that would
You
be.
Don't need to respond to that.
Well, I want to speak for a moment at least about Dunlap, because Dunlap is really the only case that my friends suggest comes close to supporting the theory that one can unintentionally violate the duty, the implied covenant. I don't think that's what that decision holds. It was in the first place in a unique setting. It was involved in a legally complex situation of the relationship between an insurance company and its insured, and there are a whole lot of rules that apply there that don't seem to apply anywhere else. The case does not suggest that the insurer acted accidentally. It does not hold that the insurer's quite intentionally arbitrary and unreasonable conduct might well prove actionable because it reflected an absence of bad faith that was not, I'm sorry, an absence of good faith that was not in bad faith. It quite plainly holds that the insurer took purposeful action to undermine an implied term of the insurance contract. So I would repeat again that I don't think we've seen a case, perhaps this will be the first, but I hope not, in which there has been found a violation of the implied covenant in the absence of a purposeful state of mind, a culpable state of mind on behalf of the actor.
And so is it your position that someone in complete good faith and with all good motive couldn't propose something that is just unfair?
Propose something, Your Honor?
You know, come up with a solution that's unfair. In complete good faith, you know, no malice, they'd say, here's my solution, and everyone looking at the solution objectively would say, well, that's not fair.
Well, you know, this is sort of a circular exercise in which we are engaged. The court seemed to, it reminds me of Mr. Justice Stewart, was it, definition of obscenity. This is a far easier principle to identify than to define. I think that you have to assume that the solution is a part of the original contract in order to find that it breached an implied provision of that contract. Simply coming up with a solution free and clear of the contract to address a problem that was not contemplated and is not addressed in the contract, I don't think is the appropriate subject for this sort of a claim. Maybe there's some tortious.
Now, I understand, but this original contract had a deadline with a date and time. And it's not a stretch to say, well, if you're going to extend it, you ought to extend it to another date and another time. Right?
Yes, and we did.
And how did anyone know that?
Well, because we called them up and said the deadline has not been, the flag hasn't flown yet. If you get your it's possible that you can get, you can, it's still possible that you can get your election in before that flag falls. People were put on notice of that. I don't think it's reasonable to assume that people would have reacted any differently to that warning if it had had an hour attached to it.
You don't think it's reasonable to assume that if they knew that the drop-dead date and time was January 18th, 5 o'clock, and after that nothing further will be accepted, that wouldn't have any influence on behavior?
I don't. Certainly it would not have had any influence on Mr. Mercele's behavior.
How do you know that?
He would have gone to bed anyway, you're saying, knowing that if he went to bed, he missed the deadline.
He arrived in Nevada at 7 p.m. Nevada time to receive an email, a fax, voicemail message, all of which said, you've got to respond to this. His assistant wrote on the fax, he ended it with this sort of Nike-inspired entreaty, do it. You have to do this or you're going to lose your rights. He didn't. This is not a class action on behalf of all of the other members. This is about Mr. Mercele and what Mr. Mercele was told and what he did in response. And I think, frankly, to claim that he's a victim here is neither persuasive on this record or...
He was playing Russian roulette?
Sorry?
He was playing Russian roulette?
I don't know what he was doing, Your Honor. He was not responding in the expeditious way that appeared to be called for.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Please support. Just like to clarify a few factual matters that from the trial record that we've just been speaking about. In terms of Mr. Mercele and what's been described as his serial indifference, it couldn't be further from the truth. Again, Mr. Mercele did not receive an election form like many others did not receive. His assistant, based on his instructions, started calling even before the deadline when he was told by member services, It'll be sent in the mail soon, or they were then told it was mailed out, you should be getting it. She spoke to people in member services even at January 4th, 2007, the day before the deadline. And while they're preaching up and down now that they cared about all these future customers, the trial record was clear that apparently member services would not volunteer information about the election deadline unless specifically asked about it. She didn't know, the assistant didn't know specifically what to ask for. She didn't use the magic word election. So she kept telling people, I didn't get the mailing. I need the mailing. And so on January 4th, nobody said, oh, by the way, the election deadline's tomorrow. She leaves another message on January 4th. She leaves another message on January 10th. Still hasn't gotten the mailing.
Well, she wouldn't need one for January 4th, would she? Because the agreement said January 5th. The issue is the extent to which it was extended beyond that.
Your Honor, so I'm clear, they didn't have the actual agreement. Election form was the only document that displayed the January 5th deadline. It's in the record. If you didn't have that document, then someone specifically had to tell you about it. There was nowhere else.
So all these factual disputes that you've raised, were they resolved by the chancellor?
Yes. Chancellor Chandler, is my reading of his decision, essentially found that these did not amount to the bad faith, the malice vis-a-vis Mr. Mercele. But if I can just continue.
Well, did he resolve which scenario was factually correct, or did he just say it really doesn't matter for the purpose of my ruling?
He said it really doesn't matter because the treatment that Mr. Mercele got vis-a-vis Mr. Davis and Mr. Bowling, who had direct contact with Mr. Sprecher, was drastically different. And this goes to the point that was raised by counsel. On January 10th, my client's assistant left another message. She gets a call back on January 12th. She thinks that this is in response to her message, And she tells the member services person, I still haven't gotten anything. I have gotten nothing. I need everything. That's what she says. Now, she didn't use the secret magic word election, apparently, because she didn't really know what she was looking for. She just said, I never got a mailing. I need everything regarding the mailing, everything regarding the merger agreement. Apparently, on January 12th, this member services was only calling about a pledge form that also had to be submitted. Now, the pledge form, there was some urgency there, but that was actually due February 1st. So that was actually a few weeks out for that. There was incredible urgency to the actual election form, which was passed too. He was never told about that. So she says, I need everything. The testimony is even that this member services person understood that she was confused about the form she needed, yet she still didn't volunteer that, oh, there's actually two different forms. Other people that said the magic words because of those January 12th calls about the pledge form, they got an election form. But unfortunately, the plaintiff's assistant didn't say that magic word, so she gets a pledge form. She says, I need everything regarding the merger agreement. She gets a pledge form. The client is out of town at this point. He comes back in and is able to sign it, and they send it back before the close of business on January 18th. Exactly to the point, if we had the election form, if we knew that the deadline was when it supposedly became, we would have had every opportunity, as we did. We sent back the pledge form before 5 p.m. on January 18th, not knowing that that was not everything that was needed. At that point, once that election form gets sent back, then is when plaintiff's assistant first learns there's something else called an election form. We then, for the first time, get that election form just before 5 p.m. on January 18th, the very first time that we ever get that election form, and it says on it, January 5th, 2007 deadline. And at that point, they say, you've got to get that thing right in. Now, at that point, my client is literally in flight, and he arrives 7 p.m. New York time. He arrives in Las Vegas for a business trip 10 p.m., okay, 10 p.m. local time. He gets to the hotel probably close to midnight. It's not clear from the record whether he actually was able to access the fax that night or he got it the next morning, okay, but he got it in as soon as he can the next morning. Now, contrast that, talk about indifference, to Bowling and Davis. January 12th, Mr. Bowling gets on the phone with Mr. Sprecher, and Mr. Sprecher tells him, I'm going to go research on your behalf whether or not we can accept a late election. Sprecher actually calls Mr. Bowling back. Okay, Mr. Bowling is helped by all levels at NIBOT, and he gets his election in on January 17th. Okay, 5 days later, Davis.
Are you saying the record reflects your client got the election form at 5 p.m.
Before 5 p.m. on the 18th,
and got it in by 2 p.m. the next day?
Yes. In less than 24 hours, much quicker, I might add, than Mr. Davis or Mr. Sprecher. Now, Mr. Davis, remember, member services wasn't volunteering information to my client. Mr. Davis calls up his CEO friend, and that friend, granted, there was some issue on that, but they knew each other, and he gets him on the phone. They had prior dealings, and they're talking about other matters. Mr. Sprecher volunteers to Mr. Davis, oh, by the way, if you didn't get your election form, and you better get it in. Davis didn't know what he was talking about, but because he was able to get on the phone with Sprecher, he then finds out and he gets it in about 2 days later. Again, much slower than my client. And again, there's nothing in the record. I see I'm just about out of time. Nothing in the record to support that January 29th date.
Well, crawling in the weeds of all the facts is something we don't normally do. But while the assistant was apparently confused by what was going on, does the record reflect whether she said that to your client and your client then decided, well, there's one way to get to the bottom of this, and for me to call the CEO. Did she ever communicate her consternation that she may not have had all the information she needed in time for him to make a similar call to Mr. Davis?
Well, I think what there is in the record is when she finally learned that there was that other document, and she thought she was done when she got the pledge form, when she found just before 5 p.m. on the 18th that there was this other election form, and her client was her boss was now in flight. She told the member services person that he wants his seats. Please escalate this to whatever level possible, to legal, to whoever. That didn't get passed up the chain at all. Nobody knew about that.
The record doesn't reflect what conversation she had when she called before she got the pledge form, that she talked to your client at all about forms, number of forms, nature of forms, deadlines or non-deadlines or extensions of deadlines. That conversation didn't take place. She was basically handling it for him.
The assistant was handling this information and was reporting back to her. He had been busy on a few different trips. But
did she talk to him about her consternation that she may not have had all the information she needed.
Yes.
Did he act on that?
He acted on that, but not by calling the CEO, not by trying to call the CEO, if that's your question. And there's only two people in all of January 2007, two NYBOT members, that ever spoke to Mr. Sprecher, and that's Mr. Bowling and Mr. Davis.
Well, there's anything, any finding by the chancellor that the only two he would have listened to?
No. The Chancellor Chandler suggests that there's no reason to believe that if my client called Mr. Sprecher that he wouldn't have taken his call. But I suggest that it's speculation and it's not supported. Again, there are only two members that ever spoke to Mr. Sprecher, and there's a member services department handling these calls that my client has spoke to for years.
Okay. Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.